I'm Beth Golay, and this is Marginalia. In a career spanning more than 30 years, Irish novelist John Boyne has published 18 novels for adults, 6 novels for younger readers, a short story collection, and a picture book. He's best known for The Boy in the Striped Pajamas, which was a New York Times number one bestseller and adapted for film, theater, opera, and ballet, selling more than 11 million copies worldwide. Among his many international bestsellers are The Heart's Invisible Furies, A Ladder to the Sky, and All the Broken Places. Boyne's newest novel, The Elements, is a collection of 4 stories that examines sexual abuse from 4 perspectives: the enabler, the accomplice, the perpetrator, and the victim. Each of the 4 elements, water, earth, fire, and air, was released in serial form in the UK. Now, published together, they make up a collection that encourages readers to reconsider how they think about sexual abuse. I recently spoke with John Boyne about The Elements, and here's our conversation. So The Elements is a novel made up of 4 parts, connected by the 4 elements, but also recurring characters. Can you give our listeners a description of the novel?
Yes. As you say, it's 4 parts: water, earth, fire, and air. And each of them are standalone stories, but they are completely connected. So a minor character from each becomes the narrator of the next one. And we kind of work around in a circle. So characters from each kind of bounce in and out. But the overriding theme of the book is about sexual abuse. But I'm looking at it in 4 different perspectives. So from an enabler, from complicity, from perpetrator, and from victim. So together they make up one novel.
And did one story come first? I mean, how did you decide who was going to tell the next story? Did you write them in the order that they appear in The Elements?
I did. In the UK, they were published first. They were actually published individually every 6 months over the last 2 years. So they were just like short novellas, but then we put them together into one book, as well as in the way that they're doing in the States. And so I started with water, and I started with this idea of a woman who has, she's leaving a very long-term marriage and is traveling across Ireland to a small island off the west coast of Ireland, where she has to confront the fact that we learn very early on that her husband has been imprisoned for crimes against children. And she has to ask herself, has she enabled that over the years? She doesn't know the answer to that question. She's spending a year there to figure it out. So as I was writing that short book, the idea for the foursome came to me. And that's when I thought about the minor character idea. So what I did was really just let the story build in the way that it would naturally, organically. And then when I would get to the end of the first draft, I'd have chosen somebody who I thought, right, well, they're going to be the person I'm going to focus on in the next book. So I might give them like just a little extra scene or 2, but not very much. I just wanted them to be very, very minor, but that if you read all 4 books together, there would always be these little connections between them.
Let's talk about the elements. And here I mean water, earth, fire, and air. You know, separately, they hold great importance for the principal character in each section. In water, Willow reflects, the elements are our greatest friends, our animators. They feed us, warm us, give us life, and yet conspire to kill us at every juncture. And later, one of the characters comments on how the elements destroy everything. Can you talk about the elements and the power they hold?
Yes, well, these are the 4 traditional building blocks of the universe. But, you know, as you mentioned in that excerpt, that we need all of these to survive, but they can also kill us. You know, we need water, but we can drown. You know, so they are as important to us as they are fatal. And I wanted to kind of think about that idea. So I used those themes for each of the characters. So with water, for example, with Willow, she's on an island. She's surrounded by water. Her husband was a swimming coach. In Earth, Evan is a footballer, but he's grown up on a farm. You know, he's very much grown up with his hands in the soil. I even used the letters. So it's water, Willow, Earth, Evan, fire, Freya, air, Aaron. Sometimes I say that when I'm doing festival events and people go, oh, God, didn't see that. You know, it's like a little small thing. But I think readers coming to the whole 4 books will probably see in each one the way I use each theme to describe the characters, to find some sort of depth to each character that I'm writing about.
So you mentioned that you were writing from four perspectives of crime: the enabler, the accomplice, the perpetrator, and the victim. But I also wonder about writing from a specific gender perspective. Can you talk about writing the female voice? Because two of the four stories are told from a woman's perspective. Was that a challenge?
Well, I knew starting out that I wanted to write basically two boys, two girls, adults, you know, two men, two women. And I wanted to mix it up in that way. It's actually not as challenging to do that as people sometimes think. I've written two novels before, in fact, This House is Haunted and All the Broken Places, which were both narrated by women. And, you know, I've written a lot of novels which are historically based. And so I don't think it's any different sort of pretending to be a soldier from the First World War or a Russian bodyguard in the Tsar's days than it is to, you know, imagine what it is to be a woman. So I think every novelist has to use their imagination every time. So I don't find it that difficult. And I think actually more men should write stronger female characters and write occasionally from the perspective of a woman. It gives you a different insight into the story.
This book challenges the reader to consider what they expect from men and women in terms of who is the perpetrator of violence and who is the victim. Sometimes this is explicit through dialogue and sometimes it's implied. For example, late in the book, a minor character, Charlotte, comments that she thinks a daughter would have been easier to raise than a son, but then adds that girls are so much more vulnerable than boys. Can you talk a little bit about this, you know, challenging these gender roles?
Yes, I think the biggest way I've challenged them is in the third section, Fire, where the perpetrator isn't a man, it's a woman. And she's somebody who's abusing young boys. And we read a lot, of course, I mean, the majority of sexual crimes are committed, of course, by men, but not all. And I have found in recent years that we seem to read a lot about, it's often teachers, female teachers who are abusing their male students or raping their male students, because actually once it's a minor, it's rape, you know, there's no other word for it. And one thing that's always bothered me is that when you see those stories, you'll often get men say, oh, I wish that had happened to me in school. I wish my female teacher had done that. But they'd probably be the same people who would be out with the pitchforks if their daughter was abused in school, and, you know, rightly so. And I wanted to get across the idea that there is no difference, really, that the effect that sexual abuse can have on a girl is exactly the same as it can have on a boy. Perhaps with a boy, it might take longer for them to realize that effect, but it will be there. You know, nobody should be abused at a young age. It doesn't matter whether you're a boy or a girl. So I wanted to challenge that a little bit and to just recognize the fact that it happens to boys too.
There were moments in the book when someone had been exposed as doing something horrible, and amid the uproar, a supporter would emerge, issue an apology for offending anyone by showing support, but not really apologize because they had meant what they said. And then another scandal would emerge, taking the focus and the public ire with it. It felt like these defenders were men defending men. Are we more forgiving of men than of women in society?
I think we probably are. I think we're just accustomed to doing it. And yeah, there are scenes where there's one particular scene I remember where a man is explaining to Willow in the first section about what led him to prison, which was a drink driving crash. And he tells his story in quite an emotional way. And in writing it, even though I'm the one writing it, I felt what he's doing is he's waiting for her to kind of reach across and say, it's okay, you know, you served your sentence and you're forgiven by society and all this. And he justifies what he has done by saying, you know, the thing about me is, and he's like 50 odd, the thing about me is, you know, I'm still a teenager at heart. You know, I always feel like that. And what it takes is for her to say to him, but you're not. You're not. You're a grown man. You're a middle-aged man. And you don't get to just sort of pass it off like that and say, oh, you know, I still feel like I did when I was a kid. Because we're supposed to grow older. We're supposed to take responsibility for our actions. We're not supposed to act as adults in the impulsive way that we do when we're teenagers, when our prefrontal cortexes haven't fully formed yet. So, you know, I did want to challenge that a little bit inside it, because we are so much less forgiving of women in society. You know, there's always this thing about like being a bad mother, for example, not so much about being a bad father. Even in some of like the, you know, there's a rape case in this book. And even today, you know, rape victims can be asked in court questions about the clothing they wear, as if something about clothing allows a rape to happen or justifies it in some way. And of course it doesn't. So all of those little things, I do write a lot about gender in books and about the way that men tend to get away with things a lot more than women do. And I feel quite strong about that.
This book is so serious in nature, but peppered throughout are some laugh out loud moments. You know, how do you like your tea? As God intended, milk and three sugars. You know, there wasn't a lot of humor, but I'm wondering how you determine the correct balance in a book that is as serious as this.
I think a lot of it comes through in the rewriting. You just know instinctively where you need to lighten the mood for a moment. It's interesting you ask me this, because anytime I talk to creative writing students in universities or anything, I always say to them, no matter how dark your book is, no matter what you're writing about, try and throw in a few jokes. Honestly, it's good for the reader, but it's actually really good for the book as well. That, you know, you can build the tension, then you can sort of let the reader sort of breathe for a moment and then build it back. I mean, even in my most famous book, The Boy in the Striped Pyjamas, which is, you know, obviously a very difficult and traumatic subject matter, there are jokes in there through the kids' misunderstandings. So I think it's always really important to find moments for that. And as a writer, I think you just learn to trust your instinct on it and your gut about where is the right moment to just, you know, break this tension a little bit.
Did I see a recurring reference to David Bowie?
Yes, you did. And there's a few little things like that in the book where each story has a reference. And I chose David Bowie simply because I was listening to a lot of David Bowie at the time. And I just found a way to kind of put him into each scene, either with somebody listening on the radio or putting a record on. And I tried to find lots of little links, you know, between the four. And it was quite difficult because, as I mentioned, with the UK editions, the first two, for example, were out. The first one was out while I was writing the third. The second one was out while I was writing the fourth. So there's no way of going back to change anything. And I was thinking back to things like, you know, those sort of when Dickens was serializing in the 19th century and you wrote the piece, published it in the newspaper, and that's it. You're stuck with the story that you have. So I wanted to find these little moments. So yeah, there's a few little connections and the Bowie one is one.
So this was a true serial.
I guess it really was. Yeah. Because I mean, every 6 months here. So it was a 2-year project for me. And I'd never done that sort of thing before. It was a nice challenge.
Speaking of humor, and maybe this isn't funny, how do you pronounce the Welsh name of the town that means St. Mary's Church in the Hollow of the White Hazel near the Rapid Whirlpool and the Church of St. Tasio of the Red Cave? It's that long L-L-A-N.
Oh, yeah. I don't know. I mean, that's Welsh. I'm Irish. So it's like Clondida Clonda or something. I don't know.
Do you have a hope for what readers will take away from this book?
I hope that it'll prove a little bit provocative, that, you know, questions are asked that aren't always asked about these crimes, and that we will look at these individuals in a different way. I feel very strongly that, and I suppose it's not an original thought, but the more that we understand why people commit these acts, the more we could get to a place where there will be less of them. That, of course, we would all say, you know, that anybody who commits a sexual crime against a child, it's heinous, they should be imprisoned. But once they are, I feel the more that we can find out, well, what is their story? What is their past? What led them to this moment? Obviously, not everybody who is abused goes on to abuse, but most of those who abuse have been abused. And that's something I think we need to, and that's not to justify anything, but to understand more about the past and then help victims today in a more educated way could potentially lessen these things happening in the future. So I guess I'm trying to find ways just to look at this story in a fresh way, and maybe readers will find it, you know, thought-provoking.
Well, the book is The Elements. John Boyne, thank you so much for joining us again.
You're very welcome.
The Elements by John Boyne was published by Henry Holt & Company. And now, book reviewer Suzanne Perez looks at a new memoir that explores the darker sides of friendship, love, and addiction.
Author Elizabeth Gilbert lays it all out at the start of her new memoir, All the Way to the River. This book is my very best effort to tell the truth about what happened between me and Rhea Elias. Our friendship, our romance, our beauty, rage, and pain, Gilbert writes. It tells the story of Rhea's addiction, her relapse, and her death. It also tells the story of my own addiction and my eventual surrender into recovery. Gilbert is best known for a very different memoir, written what seems like a lifetime ago, the 2006 bestseller Eat, Pray, Love. A lot has happened to the author since that iconic journey around the world and its subsequent movie adaptation starring Julia Roberts. Most notably, the passionate friendship-turned-love affair with a woman she met as a hairdresser in 2002. Shortly after Elias was diagnosed with terminal cancer in 2016, the author announced that her marriage was over and that she'd found love with her longtime best friend. Elias was a musician, writer, filmmaker, former punk rocker, and recovering drug addict, and as Gilbert describes it, a legend to all who knew her. Gilbert says the title of All the Way to the River was inspired by the way Elias used a map of New York City as a metaphor for her relationships. First, you've got your Fifth Avenue friends, who are right in the center of the map. These are purely superficial friends or professional contacts. You don't really know them, and they don't know you. As you move farther east, you have your Second and First Avenue friends, who are more honest and vulnerable with one another. Farther still are the friends on Avenue A, B, C, or D, who maybe paid your bail or took you to rehab. And if you're really lucky, Elias explained, you might find one friend who will walk all the way to the East River with you. This is the friend who knows everything, the one you call when you have nowhere else to turn. Gilbert and Elias were all the way to the river friends. When they discovered Elias was dying, they began to refer to her death as the river. The walk to that river was dark and painful, and Gilbert pulls no punches in revealing every excruciating detail. Elias fell back into a full-blown addiction to numerous substances, and a codependent Gilbert reached a point so low that she actually contemplated murdering her. That's when the author got honest about her sex and love addiction and her own role in her partner's life and death. All the Way to the River is an impressive mashup of Gilbert's candid storytelling along with poems, drawings, prayers, and doodles that she crafted during her recovery. It's a perilous journey to be somebody's all the way to the river relationship, Gilbert writes. There is romance in it, but also danger. Intimacy at that level is rough. Anyone who has followed Gilbert's career from Eat, Pray, Love to her most recent and surprisingly upbeat novel, City of Girls, will likely appreciate this new memoir. It features the author's winsome charm despite the somber content, and it explains what has been a confusing several years for fans who follow Gilbert on social media. It even explains the buzz-cut hair. For Marginalia, I'm Suzanne Perez.
All the Way to the River by Elizabeth Gilbert was published by Riverhead Books. Joining us now is Lisa Bedoin, the owner of Books & Company in Oconomowoc, Wisconsin. She's here to share her thoughts on some books with us, new releases, forthcoming titles, or books she just can't stop thinking about. Welcome to Marginalia, Lisa.
Thank you, Beth. It's so good to see you.
So what books are on your stack?
There's so many for us to have this season. There's so many coming out. The top of my stack, though, is a book called Life and Death and Giants by Ron Rindo. It's a novel that takes place here in Wisconsin in a small town amongst an Amish community. The central character is a young boy named Gabriel whose grandparents are in the Amish community. And there's a veterinarian who's moved from Milwaukee. He's got some stuff going on in his past. Just a friendship between the family and this young boy trying to navigate the two worlds that he's in. He is a larger than life, both figuratively and physically in this community and eventually in the state of Wisconsin. And it's such a story about, you know, he weaves through football and professional wrestling and what it means to understand who we are and where we come from and what we want. It's just a great sort of fable-like story. So that's top of my list right now. And I just finished reading The Hounding by Zenobe Purvis, and it is so good. It is haunting and, again, a fable-like story about five sisters who the small village along the Thames River feel they have turned into dogs. They have the power to turn themselves into dogs. And it is quick and haunting, and it has stuck with me. I keep talking about it. I highly recommend it. It feels like there's a whole genre of novels that have that haunting feeling along the River Thames. So this is the newest installment. I think about Diane Setterfield's Once Upon a River too, but it is fantastic. And then my favorite, I think, so far this year is Buckeye by Patrick Ryan. It is just a novel that you don't even pause. It just keeps going, and it's so smooth to read. It's such a good story about two couples in a small town in Ohio, mid-century America, and how they become friends, how their lives interact together. They eventually become friends later on, and the two sons and their projectile through their lives. And it really just talks about all of the dreams that we have, the hopes that we have, and how they get sort of mixed up and turned around and rewritten. It's fantastic. Have you read it yet?
Not yet. It's on my stack.
Oh my God.
It's on my stack.
It's just one of those that is so easy to read and so satisfying. And the review that Jess Walter had in the New York Times just is spot on right. It's so good.
I'll have to look for that.
I am currently reading, and I have been waiting and waiting and waiting for this, is Lily King's new book, Heart the Lover. It's a fantastic college novel that just, with that time in life when everything is so heady and your friendship seems so intense and you're making sense out of the world and yourself and where everybody is going to end up. Your dreams start forming, and it's this relationship. She's funny. She is so good with dialogue, and I love it. Writers and Lovers was one of my favorite books. It's still one of my favorite books. She's very good at creating relationships that are generous and compassionate and sometimes a little cringeworthy. So it's fantastic. That's Heart the Lover by Lily King.
She's going to be a guest on Marginalia in a couple of weeks.
Oh, lucky you. She's such a delight. She's such a delight. When I told my booksellers that I was coming on to talk to you about books and what some of their favorites, I had a bookseller tell me she was so excited to have a new, it's called Monk and Robot, and it's two sort of novellas that Becky Chambers wrote, and they're in one beautiful paperback edition now, and my bookseller, so excited about this. It's a hopeful and lovely novel. So the main question in the book is, if all human needs are met, can we still feel purpose and fulfillment? And the robot's mission is to find out what people need and to try and define what a need is. And she said it is just a delight to read, and it really feels uplifting and hopeful about the world. So I think that's a good recommendation for people to read now. And then because it's short pieces, it'll be a fast read if you need a fast read. Another one everyone's really excited about too, and I'm sure you've talked about it and people know about it, is The Correspondent. And it's by Virginia Evans. People just keep reading it and coming in and talking about it. It is a woman who is writing letters to authors and the imagined correspondence. Everyone just keeps passing it around in the store to read it. So that's another one. If you haven't read it yet and you have sort of slipped past it, definitely take a peek at it. I think it's going to fill that space like Love and Saffron did, where you see the power of writing letters and corresponding with people to build those relationships that you don't have day to day. So the other book that we're talking a lot about in the store is Go as a River by Shelley Reed. And it takes place in Southern Colorado in the Gunnison River Valley. And it's about a young woman. It begins in World War II. She's lost her mother. She's being raised by her father. And, you know, so it's just her and her brother and her father. And they had great loss with her mother dying and an aunt and a favorite cousin. And so she's kind of left on her own as a woman on this orchard, this peach orchard, trying to navigate her way through this small town. And then she meets a stranger in town, and it sort of changes her whole trajectory of her life. And you get the magic of this book is how she writes the landscape and the relationships. And it's really told through the main character's perspective of that time. And she has to make some big choices when the government wants to dam the Gunnison River and flood out her town. She has to decide what she's going to do with the land and if she's going to abandon the peach orchard or if she's going to move it. And the peach orchard really has a wonderful sort of symbolic way in the story. There's a lot to talk about. And again, it's just a really good story that you don't expect to go where it goes. And the last one is by John Boyne, the author that you just had on the show today. His new one, The Elements, is just getting amazing reviews. And I picked it up to kind of see what it was like. And I read a page and I could not stop reading it. I stood there holding this book, and it's not a light hardcover. And I just was enraptured with the writing and where the story was going. So I think that'll be a wonderful book for people to read and give as a gift.
Is there a book in your life, and I'm talking your whole life, that you can't let go of, that will always mean something to you, that you will always put in somebody's hands?
Oh, gosh, that's hard. Just one? There are books that I keep in the store that I want to have, even though we sell maybe one a year. Because when the right person comes, I want them to have it. Yeah. Yeah. It's hard because there is never just one.
Yeah. What's the book?
Refuge by Terry Tempest Williams. And it's the first time I read a book that took nature writing and memoir and history and wove it into something that was pure magic.
Well, you've given us a lot of books to think about. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Beth. It's always a delight.
We will have a list of Lisa's book recommendations on our website at kmuw.org. Next week on Marginalia.
I had an interesting conversation with a friend of mine who read the book, and she was a bookseller once upon a time, and she's read a zillion books. And she said to me, "Jane, this is such a brave book." And I said, "What are you talking about? It's an old-fashioned coming-of-age story." And she said, "That's why it's brave, because it's old-fashioned." And I didn't set out to write anything that was newfangled or old-fashioned. I wanted to tell this particular story. But I'm interested in writers like Rachel Cusk, who her goal is to destabilize her reader and to do away the old forms. Let's not have any sense of time necessarily in the book and a plot and all those things that some of us think are essential to a narrative. But I'm not really interested in destabilizing the reader, and I feel happy to be old-fashioned, whatsoever that means.
We speak with Jane Hamilton about her book, The Phoebe Variations. Marginalia was produced at KMUW Wichita and is part of the NPR network. Our editors and producers for this week's show are Haley Krausen, Luann Stevens, and Carly Cooper. Torin Anderson composed our theme music. This is Marginalia, and I'm Beth Golay.
It's rare to find a podcast that can actually change your life. But when the show's called Life Kit, that's kind of the whole point. I'm Mariel Segarra. 3 times a week on the Life Kit podcast, we guide you through a topic we could all use help with, from personal development to healthy living to managing your dinero, with takeaways so you can start living what you learn right away. Escucha el Life Kit podcast from NPR.